I have only one item on the agenda today. It is House Bill 2007, and I want to thank all of you who came to testify on this. We will start out with counsel summarizing the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. By executive order, Governor Kulongoski established the Governor's Task Force on Equality in Oregon. In a report issued December 14, 2006, the task force included recommendation number 2, which I'll quote, "The state of Oregon should recognize same-sex relationships in a manner that confers important rights, benefits, and responsibilities on committed same-sex couples within the limits of Measure 36. Measure 36, codified at Article 1, Section 5A of the Oregon Constitution, states that it is, quote, the policy of Oregon and its political subdivisions that only a marriage between one man and one woman shall be valid or legally recognized as marriage. House Bill 2007A would implement the task force recommendation by allowing qualified adults who enter into domestic partnerships to share the rights, benefits, and responsibilities that the state provides to married couples, while recognizing that the bill does not bestow the status of marriage on domestic partners. House Bill 2007A creates domestic partnerships, which are defined as civil contracts entered into by two qualified adults of the same sex, at least one of whom is an Oregon resident. The bill establishes eligibility, procedure, and fees for the creation of a domestic partnership, including requiring the individuals to sign a, quote, declaration of domestic partnership and file with the county clerk. The bill establishes that domestic partners have similar responsibilities, privileges, immunities, rights, and benefits of married couples and, if applicable, divorced couples. The bill requires Oregon circuit courts, to hear disputes relating to domestic partnerships, such as actions for dissolution, annulment, or legal separation, so long as the partnership was created and filed in Oregon.
Okay, we'll start out today by calling a panel of the governor's task force.
Madam Chair.
Senator Barr.
While they're coming forward, could I ask counsel a question or two?
Yes, you may.
Thank you. First of all, the legislative findings section in this bill appears it will be added to statute, which is not typical for, at least it doesn't seem typical, but usually legislative findings are a preamble to a bill and not going to be added to statute. Are these, in fact, going to be added to statute, or do you know the answer to that?
I do not know the answer to that. I assume from reading the version that we have that it would be added to the bill. I mean, they wouldn't. It would just have I think it would have the same effect as whether it was the preamble or added to the bill. They're just the findings of the legislature, but I can't answer that for certain.
Thank you. And, Madam Chair, I don't know if anyone from Legislative Council will be able to answer that question, probably the end of the committee or not. Hopefully someone from Legislative Council would be listening to be able to answer that question.
If there's someone listening from Legislative Council or Mr. Taylor who can add some elucidation on whether the findings in the bill will, what you're asking is whether they'll be incorporated in the ORS.
Yes, whether they will become part of the ORS.
Whether they will be incorporated, we'd appreciate a visit and a note.
Thank you. One other question, Madam Chair, of counsel would be, and again, this is probably a question that Legislative Council would have to answer, but I'd like to ask it now, get it on the record. This bill, normally when you see a bill, you have some idea of where it's going to be codified in statute and which statutes will be affected by this bill. Section 9 simply says that all, the term is, any privilege, immunity, right, or benefit granted by statute, administrative, or court rule, policy, common law, or any other law to an individual. Again, this is probably a Legislative Council question, but to get on the record, is there any listing someplace of the number of the statutes that will be affected by this bill, what they are, and how they will be affected by the bill?
Just so I understand your question, you're asking which statutes talk about the privileges and immunities and benefits that are being amended, essentially?
Yes, and again, I recognize that it's probably a Legislative Council question, but just to clarify, normally when we see a bill, we know what's going to be amended by the bill, but this bill seems to amend everything without mentioning anything.
Right. The answer is I don't know. I don't know which specific provisions of ORS would be amended by the statute. I do think the way it's drafted, its intent is to just sweep into, you know, all the sections of the code that confer benefits or responsibilities on married couples, and
so there's no way to know what that is.
I mean, not by this bill itself. So,
thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Beyer, we've just gotten word from the Governor's Council that the findings could be will be made part of the ORS, and that Legislative Council has advised that it can be done that way.
So that answers my question. It will be part of it.
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. We will start with the Governor's Task Force, Bruce Sampson, Dan Bryant, and Sho DiSono.
Who just violated your...
Yep. We have not only in this room, I think it's like next door where I serve on revenue. If you have a cell phone, even if you put it on silent or vibrate, at any time someone calls in, it makes the whole sound system go berserko. So be forewarned. Welcome.
And Madam Chair, this is the committee hearing room that my committee is in, and we make people make a contribution to the Common School Fund when the cell phone goes off. That's how we fund education in Oregon, sir.
But today we are the Senate Judiciary Committee, where I have been beaten down on the subject of cell phones, and I will not impose any fines. And again, welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. My name is Bruce Sampson, and I want to thank you for this opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 2007. I am here as a member of the Governor's Task Force on Equality, and also as a retired business person who has served as chair of the Portland Chamber of Commerce Board, general counsel for Northwest Natural Gas, and Quest in the 80s and 90s. I am accompanied today on this as also members of the panel by Sho DiSono, a Portland business leader, and Dan Bryant, who is the senior minister of the First Christian Church in Eugene. I think that you've generally heard the background of this task force. And by the way, I do have additional copies of the report if one of you needs them or would like to look at them.
I think, Madam Chair, we all got that report on Senate Bill 2 when there was testimony on Senate Bill 2.
Let me just hand these.
Here, I'll just give them to counsel. Yeah, the staff. Thank you.
This was an 11-member task force that was appointed in February of 2006 and started its work in April and finished its work with a report to the governor in December of 2006. We had public testimony in four communities in Oregon: Bend, Lincoln City, Portland, and Medford. We had over 100 citizens testify at those hearings, and then we had a special hearing for the Oregon Family Council in Portland. The recommendation has been read to you by the counsel for the committee. The committee believes that this is essentially a civil rights issue. Essentially, we believe that there are many important rights that are granted same-sex couples and that are granted opposite-sex couples and families that are denied to same-sex couples and families. And on page 20 of our report, it lists some of these: no automatic right to make health decisions or visit the partner in a hospital, no right to intestate succession and other benefits under probate and property law, no marital privilege against certain forms of testimony, no right to bring a wrongful death action in the case of the death of a spouse, no right to spousal support in the event of marital dissolution, no ability of a spouse to obtain health insurance through the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, no death benefits under Oregon's workman's compensation laws, no homestead exemption for a spouse's abode from sale on the execution of a judgment, no right of a spouse to consent to an autopsy control a disposition of remains, no right to private visits or cohabitation in nursing homes, and no joint liability of husband and wife for the support and expenses educating the family, and no ability to file a joint personal income tax return. In Medford, I just want to give one example of the kind of testimony that we received. Dr. Delta Ferguson is a university professor at Southern Oregon University. She is the partner of another woman, and they have an in vitro pregnancy and birth. She has to pay for the benefits for that child. And the amount that she pays are imputed to her income for Oregon State income tax purposes. And in addition to that, even though this was a birth that occurred while the two were together, she had to adopt that child as opposed to that child being a member of the family. The cost of the adoption was $1,000. The imputed Oregon State income tax is also a very significant sum. These are the kind of rights that a same-sex family does not have under current law, and there are many, many others. I think you've probably seen the list of some 100 rights that same-sex couples have, or that same-sex couples do not have, that opposite-sex couples do. The task force believes that in order to make our laws truly non-discriminatory and truly to protect the families, the children, and members of all of the families in Oregon, it would be very important for you to pass House Bill 2007. And that concludes my testimony.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from the panel? Thank you. Reverend Bryant.
Hi, I'm Dan Bryant, and as Bruce said, I am pastor of First Christian Church, Disciples of Christ in the Heart of Eugene, and I was pleased to serve as actually one of two clergy on this 11-member task force. I'm also representing today Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon, of which I'm a current board member and the immediate past president. EMO is a statewide organization of 17 Christian denominations and one of the largest organizations of its kind in the country. I'm pleased to report to you that EMO's Board of Directors fully supports HB 2007. We believe that our support for this bill is firmly rooted in the biblical principles of loving our neighbor, liberating the oppressed, and protecting the rights and dignity of those harmed by society. So why would a Christian pastor such as myself support domestic partnership for same-sex couples? Contrary to those who claim that such is anti-Christian, anti-marriage, or contrary to family values, I find the reverse to be true, and this bill to be fully consistent with the Christian faith I profess and have proclaimed from the pulpit for 23 years. Attitudes in churches across the country toward homosexuality have gone through a tremendous change over the last few decades, as we come to the same recognition as did the Apostle Peter when faced with a very similar issue, that God shows no partiality. If all beings are created in the image of God, it therefore follows that our sexual identity is part of that image. Thus, many Christians believe that we are created with different sexual orientations, just as we are created with different skin color, and that a homosexual reflects the image of God no differently than a heterosexual. We have defined marriage in this state as the union between one man and one woman. House Bill 2007 does not change that. It simply establishes a separate legal framework for granting protections, rights, and responsibilities to committed same-sex partners and their families. Children of same-sex couples in particular need the legal protection that domestic partnerships will provide. The differences between marriage and domestic partnership are significant. Oregon's domestic partnerships would not be recognized in other states or by the federal government, nor can be solemnized by clergy. It is clearly not marriage by another name. Bruce mentioned issues with tax code. This does not change tax code, unfortunately, and those couples will not be able to enjoy those benefits that heterosexual couples enjoy. When I came to the Eugene congregation 16 years ago, there were no openly gay or lesbian members, let alone couples. Today, we have 5 same-sex couples active to a variety of degree in the congregation. And I'm very pleased to serve a congregation like hundreds more in our state, which does not discriminate against members on the basis of sexual orientation. For the same-sex couples active in our congregation, this bill is an incredibly important recognition that their relationships of love and commitment are valid and appropriate. I know these couples well. I have been in their homes. I have watched them care for their grandchildren. I've heard their stories of hurt and pain. They desire nothing more than any other couple in our state: love, acceptance, a place to call home, and fair treatment by their government. Listen how ordinary the relationship of this couple in our congregation sounds, but how excluded they feel. Amy and I have a commitment and arrangement that is very similar to many other couples who are married with children. Amy stays home and supports the family in her role as a co-parent, primary care provider for our granddaughter, and housewife. Amy does most of the household chores, such as laundry, dishes, shopping, and paying the bills, while I work outside the home. I bring home the bacon, she fries it up in the pan. We make decisions together and are co-benefactors of our choices. Our relationship, if it were heterosexual, would be granted many benefits. However, because Amy and I are both women, we do not qualify for many spousal benefits concerning tax breaks, medical emergency decision-making, medical coverage, hospital visiting rights, property rights, retirement, on and on. End of quote. Another member of our congregation, whose partner just had surgery for potentially life-threatening illness, writes the following: domestic partnership recognition is extremely important for me. The most important benefits to me are of legal nature. Since our partnership, which is now in its 16th year, is not recognized, we pay higher taxes, for example. Jay, I'll leave out his name, does not have health insurance. Lucky for us, especially considering all the health costs from his operation, the university offers domestic partner health benefits. Save the day, right? Not yet. The federal government considers the health insurance premium the university pays extra income for me, so I have to pay over $200 a month in tax on that. For several reasons, the house is in his name. If he dies, I do not automatically inherit. We saw an attorney just before his operation to help us make a will and make that will watertight to prevent that will from being contested by family. We also made an advance directive and spelled out that I have access to Jay in case he is in the ICU, normally only available to kin, can make life and death decisions if he is not able to do those for himself, make the funeral arrangements, and have access to the body, etc. There are symbolic aspects to the recognition of domestic partnership also, but the most important to me are the legal aspects, and these are just a few of the many I've outlined. I do not care whether this is called partnership or marriage or something else, but it is important that we have something. End of quote. The time has come for Oregon to provide something to these couples. They have earned it with their years of devotion to their relationships. They deserve it for our years of moral condemnation and immoral discrimination. I urge you to grant domestic partnership to the thousands of couples in our state for whom something is everything. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from the panel?
Yeah, Madam Chair. Thank you. I found the section. It's on page 5. I'm concerned about this tax treatment. I didn't know until you all spoke that there's no tax benefits inured to domestic partnerships, which is really a shame. But it says that right in sub 6 on lines 11 through 16. Gentlemen, unless the tax code is changed to recognize domestic partnerships as a marriage, so to speak, under the tax code, there are no benefits.
My understanding, someone might be better qualified to speak to this.
Let's let counsel address that.
Thank you. If you look at sub 8 on page 5, it says, for purposes of administering Oregon tax laws, partners in a domestic partnership, surviving partners in domestic partnership, and the children have the same privileges, immunities, rights, benefits, and responsibilities as are granted to or imposed on spouses
So for purposes of Oregon tax laws, they would have the benefits, just not the federal ones.
That's but under federal law, we
under federal law, they would not.
What a shame.
That's my understanding also.
That's right. And the section you were referring to deals with pension plan benefits. So that's
okay. Great. All right. Thank you. And Reverend Bryant, thank you so much for what you do. I appreciate your contribution to the community and the state of Oregon. He's from my community, so I know about all of his good work. But
you're from my district.
Don't argue with me about that. We fight over that all the time about
the
who's in whose district.
I have
thank
well,
you.
You're in front of my committee, so we're all claiming you. Okay, thank you. Show.
Madam Chair and the committee, my name is Joe DeZono from Osmond, our travel service. I've been in business in Portland, Oregon for over 30 years. Like Bruce Sampson, I had the privilege of serving as the chair of the Portland Chamber of Commerce in 2001 and a current member of the Portland Business Alliance. I've been very active in the business community for all of my business life. Today I would like to simply talk as a business person how this might impact our employees. And from that perspective, I'm absolutely supportive of this domestic partnership. I had one employee in my employment that was married under the Multnomah County when it was allowed and was annulled with the passage of Measure 36. And I'm sure he's looking forward to an opportunity to have a civil union that would grant him the legal rights that many of the same-sex couples are enjoying in my employment. I think in the testimony was referred to a number of large employers in Portland area and throughout the state that testified to our commission. Julie Brimman Edwards is in presence in the audience today representing Nike. Nike has stated publicly that this is a good business policy, attracting the best and brightest from all over the country and the world when we treat all of our employees equally and provide equal domestic partnership for whether same sex or opposite sex. And from that perspective, we had a unanimous vote of the Portland Business Alliance to endorse both the Senate bill and House bill. So I think you do have a business community that you may have perceived to be maybe an opposite side in some cases, but unanimous by all the board members that were present there last month and voting for equal protection, non-discrimination, along with the domestic partnership benefits. It may provide some additional cost to the companies, but from a business perspective, it's simply a good policy to treat all of our employees the same, provide the same benefits, and I think this is the way the business will be in the future.
Thank you very much. Questions? Thank you very much. Okay, our next panel will be the Oregon Family Council. These are 15-minute panels. We actually made it within that for the previous panel, so welcome.
Good afternoon. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Nick Graham, representing the Oregon Family Council. Thought I would start by mentioning that as you probably notice on the roster there, there's very few people here testifying in opposition to the bill this afternoon. I would like to remind the committee that over 500 Oregonians came to testify in opposition on the House side, and I would ask that you take that testimony into consideration as you deliberate this legislation. Although they couldn't be here today, their opposition to this bill is just as strong and now as it was then. So, and if you'd like me to, I'm not sure, are you keeping the record open for any period of time during this committee, or is it closed at 3 o'clock?
We can keep it open to the end of the day.
So if necessary, I can provide the committee with the testimony offered to the House, if that would help.
Okay.
The Oregon Family Council represents approximately 40,000 Oregonians and nearly 2,000 Oregon churches and religious organizations. Most recently, we led the Measure 36 marriage amendment here in Oregon. Oregon Family Council is opposed to House Bill 2007. We do recognize the large effort that was made in crafting House Bill 2007 with respect to the solemnization aspects of marriage, and it appears that domestic partnerships as defined in House Bill 2007 are better aligned with at least the constitutional restrictions of Measure 36. However, 2007 says, quote, any privilege, immunity, right, or benefit by statute, administrative, or court rule, common law, or any other law to an individual because the individual is or was married is granted on equivalent terms, substantive and procedural, to an individual because the individual is or was in a domestic partnership. And although it may legally fit within the confines of Measure 36, we believe that certainly reasonable people could consider House Bill 2007 akin to gay marriage. We believe the legislature should choose an alternative approach to granting benefits that would appeal to a much more broad group of Oregonians, using House Bill 3536, referred to as reciprocal benefits. Many of the most vocal needs expressed by proponents have been offered through reciprocal benefits. Rather than rolling the dice on the potential of majority support for House Bill 2007-style domestic partnerships, it seems appropriate that the legislature adopt policy that clearly the vast, vast majority of Oregonians would support. House Bill 3536 includes over 200 benefits and responsibilities that are currently available only to married couples. The central difference is that reciprocal benefits would be available to any two people who cannot legally marry, not just to same-sex couples. We're a family organization. We try to promote stable, healthy families, and we don't want to keep parents from being able to take care of their children in the hospital or make medical decisions for one another, or many other benefits that can be critical to families, but at the same time, if you step back and think about it, the legislature is deciding whether or not to grant hundreds of benefits that the state has historically made available exclusively to married couples, beyond married couples, to other families. In the case of House Bill 2007, other families means gay and lesbian families only. However, since we're entertaining the idea of extending benefits beyond marriage, why not include other Oregon families that would benefit greatly, but don't have an intimate relationship with one another? To this end, we are supportive of the concept of reciprocal benefits. Reciprocal benefits creates a package of benefits, but makes those benefits available to any two people who cannot legally marry. This would include same-sex couples. It would also include two dependent sisters or two dependent same-sex friends that don't necessarily have a sexual relationship with one another. Lastly, and in terms of process, Senator Beyer alluded to this earlier, but nowhere in this bill can a lawmaker or a citizen actually decipher what laws are being changed. And we believe this is a pretty important point because as the legislature, you're elected to pass laws that, you know, that you deliberate and you look at and you decide to make those changes. Yet, and the citizens are in the public forum able to actually look at those laws and see those changes. Yet, in this bill, literally hundreds of statutes, administrative laws, court rulings are being changed, and no one actually knows what exactly is being changed. It's very conceptual in nature. And I think it's a real important point to make just in terms of the process. We've had a very good debate in both chambers. The process has been very public. But on this particular legislation, it seems as though we're doing a little bit of a disservice to the public and to other legislators in asking them to vote yes or no on a bill that they really don't ultimately know the outcome to, other than marriage-like rights to same-sex couples. That's really the only thing that legislators can really hang their hat on when they vote for this legislation, and it's something that we think is really important. You know, we felt it was that important that when we looked into the idea of reciprocal benefits, we actually had we investigated all the statutes that use the term marriage or spouse, those kind of things, and there were over 400 Oregon statutes that did so. Let me see, I lost my place here, excuse me. We found that there are approximately, out of those 400 plus statutes, we found that there are approximately 210 benefits and responsibilities that clearly could be included in reciprocal benefits, and in fact are included in House Bill 3536. We found about 80 or so, which are mentioned in the bill, that deal with federal law and various things that just simply could not be included. But then there was another segment of statutes in roughly 100 to 150 that we felt at the very least deserved a little bit more of a deliberative discussion. They dealt with things like divorce law, family law, other areas of law that may very well apply, but by using this broad stroke method, many of the details and discussions are simply lumped into more provocative needs, such as burial decision-making, medical decision-making, property transfer, medical benefits, all of which, by the way, are included in reciprocal benefits. And I guess in terms of just this discussion, it seems as though, you know, this process could have taken a slightly different route and really been able to delve into some of the details of these and simply just take a look and say, does this change in statute make sense or does it not, and move on. Ultimately, as we read through the preamble found in Section 2, Paragraph 6 highlights what we believe is the reason for why House Bill 2007 was drafted the way it was. And that states that the establishment of a civil union, I guess now I should change that to domestic partnership, system will provide legal recognition to same-sex relationships, thereby ensuring more equal treatment of gays and lesbians and their families under Oregon law. This strengthens the governor's task force conclusion, which I read to you on the Senate Bill 2 hearing a few weeks ago. True equality will require attitudinal evolution. Adoption of the task force's recommendations for law changes in Oregon will be just one step forward towards great societal change and acceptance. I read this to you during the Senate Bill 2 debate, and I thought it was important to read to you again and really take note of the phrase great societal change and acceptance. Words are very powerful, and the word acceptance was not chosen lightly. We believe it would be a mistake for the legislature to intend through House Bill 2007 to legally recognize same-sex relationships with the intent to require all of society to not just tolerate, but to accept homosexuality as okay. By adopting legislation with the intent to use the laws of our state to promote and ultimately require acceptance is a very, very big deal. In the same sense, I don't use the term require lightly either. However, we believe that ultimately adoption of these laws creates an environment in Oregon that says if an Oregonian is unwilling to accept this lifestyle, whether because of religious reasons or otherwise, that they are in violation of Oregon law, or at the very least, they feel like they're in violation. I say these things because we feel they are very paramount to our ability to carry on our lives according to the dictates of our faith and our belief without feeling as though we are breaking the law or being forced to compromise our belief system to accomplish the goals of a vocal minority. Please remember, tolerance works both ways. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions from the panel? Thank you. We will now call our panel of proponents. Julia Brim Edwards, Kelly Burke, Craig Arnson, I'm sorry, Todd Simmons, and Gus Martinez Padilla. Might want to divide that up into two pieces. We don't have enough chairs.
Would you like to go first, since you might, being a parent of three, I know you might have to.
Strategically, that might be wise.
What do you think of this? Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. My name is Kelly Burke, and I'm a resident of Portland, Oregon. I'm here today in support of House Bill 2007, the Oregon Family Fairness Act. My partner Dolores and I have been together for 19 years, and we're the proud parents of a 5.5-year-old son and a 1-year-old daughter. We have gone to extraordinary means and financial expense to try to protect one another and our children with wills, powers of attorney, second parent adoptions, and other legal documents available to us. But those documents only help us in the most dire of life circumstances. They have done very little to protect us in our daily life. Our experiences have shown us that the ability to take care of each other is very vulnerable and will continue to be until we are legally recognized as a family. 3 days after giving birth to our son, my doctor quickly sent me to the hospital to be evaluated for blood clots. We grabbed copies of our medical powers of attorney and rushed to the hospital, but that day they would be no use to us, especially to the most vulnerable member of our family. On the way, we were reminded that should I become incapacitated, Dolores' second parent adoption was not yet complete, and she would have no parental rights to our son. As I entered the hospital, I frantically scratched a note out listing my intentions for our child and instructing custody to Dolores. What should have just been a medical crisis instead put our three-day-old son's entire future and family unit in jeopardy. Over the next few months, as we waited for the courts to process our adoption paperwork, I worried what would become of him if tragedy struck and he was without the protection of two legal parents. I breathed a huge sigh of relief on the day his adoption was completed, September 10th, 2001. As a family, we live traditionally. I'm a stay-at-home mom. Dolores is a union electrician, and she's the sole financial support of our family. Yes. One of the most basic needs for all families is health care. And while Dolores can cover our children and an unlimited number of dependents on her... Sorry. I need a baby wrangler.
There we go.
While Dolores can cover our children and an unlimited number of dependents on her health insurance, she could not cover me. I was denied coverage because they did not recognize domestic partners as valid family members. For 5 years, we petitioned them to cover domestic partners, only to be denied repeatedly. When Multnomah County issued marriage licenses to same-sex couples, her union then considered me a valid legal family member and provided me with health insurance until the passage of Measure 36. It was only this January, when the City of Portland's Equal Benefits Ordinance took effect, that her union was willing to recognize me as part of her family unit and offered health insurance coverage to me again. While the EBO helps lift this burden from our family, we also know that if she was ever to take a job outside of Portland, we risk losing our status as a valid family. Last July, Dolores was diagnosed with breast cancer and recently completed 8 months of aggressive treatment. Being a gay couple was always an extra worry during Dolores' cancer treatment. There was not a single doctor's appointment that we did not carry our medical powers of attorney documents with us. Each new office, each new doctor, each new medical form, Dolores would have to explicitly, both verbally and written, give instructions that I was her partner, could speak on her behalf, and were there to, they were to release all information to me as needed. We are fortunate that we live in a community where most of the medical personnel we dealt with did not blink an eye. But there were a few who did, and one such incident came dangerously close to compromising her safety. A few days after her third chemo treatment, she was having trouble breathing and had deep, significant pain in her left side. I paged the 24-hour oncology service. When the return call came, I introduced myself as her partner and began to detail her symptoms, but the medical personnel informed me that she could only talk to Dolores. I again explained who I was, asked her to check Dolores' chart instructing them to talk to me, but was informed she didn't have access to her chart and could only talk with Dolores. I eventually put a very distressed Dolores on the phone, who directly asked the nurse to talk to me and handed the phone back. Fortunately, that was enough to move her care forward. But it was a scary few moments that made her even more vulnerable in a medical crisis. If anyone has come to know the power and precious nature of being recognized as a family, we have. For the last 19 years, Dolores and I have lived with all the responsibilities of a family, but with none of the legal rights and protections we so desperately need. My desire to have legal recognition of our relationship and our family comes from the trenches, doing everything I can to keep her and the kids safe.
Oh. Oh, no! It turned itself on, I swear!
That's
sorry. I think you owe my son's school a dollar.
I think so.
My desire to have legal recognition of our relationship and our family comes from the trenches of doing everything I can to keep her and our kids safe. This is not about politics for me. It's deeply personal. It's about my life, Dolores' life, the lives of our kids, and the many families like ours. To not be able to legally take care of the person you have spent the last 19 years of your life with is a painful burden to carry. I need your support, leadership, and courage to create legal recognition for my family and other families like ours. I beg you to pass House Bill 2007. The well-being of our family depends on it. Thank you.
Thank you. And if you could put in the record your secrets for having such a well-behaved child, we'd appreciate it. The parents on the panel would appreciate it.
No, it's feeling bad. I know that my kids are getting older when I didn't have anything in my pockets to distract. Or nothing that's for kids over or under 12. Good morning, Chair Burdick, members of the committee, or good afternoon. I'm Julia Brim-Edwards, Nike State and Public Affairs Director, and I'm here with Randy Lyons, Senior Project Manager for Nike Information Technology. We have some formal written testimony, but we wanted to speak informally, and between the two of us, what we want to do is represent both a company perspective and also an employee perspective on this particular bill. We're here today on behalf of the company. Oregon's only Fortune 500 company. We have about 6,900 employees in Oregon, working and living across the metro area. And we have about 27,000 employees worldwide. We have a presence in nearly every state in the U.S. and in 150 countries around the world. Nike previously testified in this committee in support of Senate Bill 2, the non-discrimination bill. And we're here today in support of House Bill 2007, the domestic partnership bill, which we think is a meaningful complement to Senate Bill 2. These two bills together support diversity and inclusion and convey a basic set of rights, responsibilities, and protections to Oregonians, Oregonians who are our coworkers, our neighbors, and our fellow citizens. From our perspective, Senate Bill 2 is good for business, and House Bill 2007 is good for our employees and our community. And here's why. First of all, we believe diversity drives innovation, a cornerstone of our business, and high-performing teams grow and thrive in an open and welcoming work environment. We also believe it provides a competitive advantage. An inclusive work environment and community enables us to attract the best and brightest from around the globe and come to Oregon to join our company or to come to Washington County where our campus is. For the record, we have submitted formal testimony and also will submit the letter that was referenced earlier of businesses and business associations that are supporting both the bills. I also wanted to, and it includes a number of employers, including Quest, PGE, Nike, Columbia Sportswear, Medford Fabrication. I also want to, for the record, submit a report called Report on the Civil Union Review Commission. This report was done following Vermont's adoption of the civil union law and found that the law had, quote, no material adverse impacts on state government, end quote, and found that individuals who entered into civil unions received positive legal and societal benefits. I think this just was outlined prior to our testimony, and greater stability for their families. From Nike's viewpoint, public policy that creates statewide, safe, non-discriminatory living and working environments will further enhance our ability to compete for top talent in the global marketplace and will help make Oregon a place that all our employees will want to call home. And now I'd like to ask Randy Lyons to provide just an employee perspective from our company.
Thank you. As Julia mentioned, my name is Randy Lyons. I'm a project manager for information technology at Nike. I'm also the chair of Nike's Gay, Lesbian, Bisexual, Transgender, and Friends Employee Resource Group. And as that chair, I represent a very strong and active membership at Nike. One of our core objectives for the Employee Resource Group is to help Nike become the employer of choice for GLBT individuals. And we significantly feel that the passage of House Bill 2007 would help us accomplish that goal. As we work on recruiting GLBT individuals to Nike, we've found that they come very well educated about Nike's history in supporting GLBT initiatives and GLBT-friendly legislation. We also find that they come very well educated about the domestic partner benefits that we offer and about our very open and welcoming environment at Nike. But we do find that as they branch out to look at the community and Oregon at large, they're always very surprised that Oregon does not recognize their same-sex relationships. So as these potential employees who may be coming from anywhere in the country or, for that matter, across the world, they're looking at not only their work life, but they're looking at the community that they will potentially be bringing their family into and how open and welcoming that community is. We find that the conversation ultimately leads to protection under the law. So this is a similar concern that I have a very personal relationship with. As I chose to bring my partner of 12 years to Oregon just a few years ago, we specifically chose Oregon as our home, and the job came later. So we chose Oregon as a place to live because of the natural beauty of the state and all that nature had to offer us here. We chose Oregon because it was a very strong volunteer community and politically active at the community level.
This is where we choose to hike, where we pay our taxes, and where we choose to make our friends. But something that we did struggle with was how well our relationship would be protected. How open and how welcoming would this community be to us as a same-sex couple? The passage of House Bill 2007 would provide hundreds of needed protections, rights, and responsibilities that would make me both feel very safe and incredibly proud to have made this choice to make Oregon the state of my home. As an Oregonian, I'm concerned about my neighbors, I'm concerned about my friends and my coworkers. I hope that they don't have to have the conversation that I have to have on a very regular basis with my mother. I have to tell my mother, who lives in Arkansas, the state that I grew up, that it is too risky for my partner and I to come home for a visit. If something unfortunate were to happen to my partner Josh or myself on that visit, I could easily be denied hospital visits. I could be denied the right to make medical decisions. This is something I weigh every time I go back for a visit. For me, the state where I was an honor graduate in my high school, where I was an all-state athlete, and where I graduated with my bachelor's degree, is not safe or welcoming for me and my partner to visit. Please pass House Bill 2007 and make Oregon a safe and welcoming place for all of its citizens. Let all of Oregon's children who venture from the state know that it's safe and welcoming to come home to. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from panel? Thank you. Okay, that panel went 15 minutes, so I'm going to hold off on the next two, take two opponents, and then I'll take the next two from this panel. Charles Felton and Ethlyn Reeves. Welcome. Charles, do you want to start?
Okay. Well, first of all, thank you very much. I'm an ordinary citizen.
Can you identify yourself for the record?
Pardon?
Identify yourself.
My name is Charles Felton, and I'm an ordinary citizen. I am here out of concern, out of great concern. I'm a grandfather. My wife and I will celebrate our 40 years of marriage this year. We have three children. We have three very lovely grandchildren. And until recently, I've been proud to be an Oregonian. House Bill 2007 is one of what someone has called one of the Oregon Trail of Bad Bills. It provides that any privilege, immunity, right, or benefit granted by law to individual who is or was married is granted to individual who was or is in domestic partnership. And I feel it's basically the same as the same-sex marriage, only by a different name. And I know, as we all know, in 2004, 57% of the Oregon voters amended the Constitution to read, "It's the policy of Oregon and its political subdivisions that only a marriage between one man and one woman shall be valid or legally recognized as a marriage." House Bill 2007, I think, ignores the vote of Oregonians and tries to circumvent this amendment by using the term domestic partnership. The state, I feel, should really be supporting traditional marriages. I mean, traditional marriages have enough difficulty as they are. I don't feel the state should be supporting same-sex marriages just because two people say they love each other, and I don't doubt this, and say they are committed to each other, and we certainly have seen that. But I don't know if that gives them the right to marry. Saying you have a right to marry, I don't think gives you that right. The Jewish and Christian scriptures, thousands of years of civilization, I think common sense all support traditional marriage. House Bill 2007, I think, does more than promote tolerance. It gives the state sanction to behaviors that are not beneficial to our society. We who oppose 2007 do not have much political power, you know. I just look at the process by which this bill went through. We have no great source of finances. We certainly do not have the media on our side. However, I dare say that our cause is a righteous cause, and we are here today to take a stand in defense of our families, our communities, and our faith. And I would respectfully ask the committee to do what's morally right and not what is politically expedient. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Other questions from the panel? Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Athlyn Reeves. I am a mother and wife in Sherwood, Oregon. I do not have something planned or something that I gave to you because I did not think I'd be sitting up here. I'm here to say that I am not opposed to the mother who is here with a child for getting benefits, or I'm opposed to the fact that I thought as an Oregonian we had already voted on this issue. And I want the right as a voter to be able to vote on this. I don't feel like I am being represented. I don't think what my belief system and my family believes and what the Bible believes and what is being represented. And so my concern is that if this is something that Oregon wants, let Oregon vote for it. And then let's decide. But I do think it's undermining what we've already voted on, but I'm not opposed to creating something else, as Oregon Family Council already represented, House Bill 3536, reciprocating rights. Let us vote on it, though. That's why we're American and not communist. I've spent a lot of my life living in Eastern European countries and socialist countries, and that is why I'm proud to call America my home. And my grandfather came through Ellis Island. It's not, and he is a minority and was a minority. I just think that as Americans we deserve the right, and as Oregonians the right to vote on this and not have it be something that is done without our understanding. And I really believe that this House bill and Senate bill 2 have been we haven't been given enough information, and as Oregonians we deserve the right to vote on these things and not have these large broad sweeping decisions be made without the Oregonians' ability to vote on it. And then we can say this is what we decided as a state. Whether I'm opposed or against it, we decided as a state. And that's all I wanted to come forward to and say today. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Questions from the panel? Thank you. Okay, now we'll take the other two members of our previous panel.
I think I'll begin. This is the consensus here. Chair Burdick and members of the committee, my name is Craig Arnson, and I am the Manager of Community Affairs for Portland General Electric. And on behalf of PGE, I want to thank you and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee for addressing this very significant issue for the state. I have submitted written testimony, which I'll summarize today. At PGE, we believe that embracing a diverse community is good for our company, for our employees, for our customers, and good for the state of Oregon. To PGE, diversity means more than hiring employees of different beliefs, national origins, or races. It means understanding and celebrating those differences and providing an environment in which all people feel welcome and can thrive. It's in that spirit in the 1990s, we began to take public stands against discrimination based on sexual orientation. We opposed Ballot Measure 9 and Ballot Measure 13. During the 97 legislative session, we supported the Employment Non-Discrimination Act that was adopted by the House. We were an early member of the Basic Rights Oregon's Fair Workplace Project, and we are the first Oregon corporation to offer a grant to the Equity Foundation as it was forming, which is a nonprofit foundation devoted to equality and dignity for all, particularly LGBT Oregonians. At PGE, we believe that every business has an obligation to adopt policies, provide training, and extend benefits to create a culture where diversity matters and people are respected. In supporting that belief, PG expanded its non-discrimination policy in 1998 to explicitly prohibit discrimination against gay and lesbian employees and began offering domestic partner benefits in that same year. Just last year, in 2006, the PGE executive team unanimously approved adding discrimination on the basis of gender identity to our non-discrimination policy. Not all Oregonians and not even all PGE employees have agreed with the company on these positions, so you can imagine how difficult those decisions were to make. But in each case, we felt it was the right thing for our company and the right thing for the state. Like many Oregon companies, we're concerned about having an adequate pool of educated, skilled, and diverse workers to run our company in the future. And it's more critical than ever that Oregon does everything we can to attract the very best and brightest top-notch employees. And on a personal note, this is not only a business issue, but it's certainly personal for me as well. Several months ago, my partner of 15 years received two job offers simultaneously from competing financial institutions. After several weeks of negotiation, he ultimately chose the company, which had stronger diversity policies and domestic partner benefits, even though the salary wasn't as high. In Oregon, we have that same opportunity as the company that prevailed in hiring my partner. To be a place where people want to work, where all people can live safely, without fear of discrimination, and where their individuality and family relationships are honored. Today, your committee is facing an historic choice, and we urge you on behalf of PGE and the 2,700 employees that work for us to stand up for equal protection for all Oregon citizens. This is really about honoring the commitments that people have made. HB 2007 ensures that people that are in same-sex relationships that have made a significant commitment to each other have many of the same rights as opposite-sex relationships have. At PGE, our experience is that the true cost of providing domestic partnerships has been very minimal, and any cost associated has actually outweighed the greater ability to attract employees and retain them, which is really important. But the changes to by employers to provide domestic partner benefits, they can only go so far. So HB 2007 is another step toward providing true equality, and while the rights provided by HB 2007 cannot travel with domestic partners to other states, it is a step in the right direction, and we urge you to support this. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you. Welcome.
Good afternoon. I'm Todd Simmons from Eugene.
And I'm Gus Martinez from Eugene.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it would be difficult for Gus or myself to describe how much the opportunity to testify means to us both today. I think it's fair to say that over the course of our 11-year relationship, we both have had doubts from time to time as to whether we might ever benefit from legal recognition and protection as a same-sex couple. The fact that we are now on the verge of getting such protections as Oregon prepares to become one of the first 10 states in the union to provide them is tremendously encouraging to us. Not only will the most important relationship in our lives be recognized by the state of Oregon, but as we begin a family later this year with the adoption of two kids, we'll be able to be recognized as parents with equal rights and responsibilities. So at this critical juncture in our lives, we applaud the Oregon legislature and Governor Ted Kulongoski for not only making this possible, but for making it a priority.
Todd and I have been involved with community work and activism for years that has made the need for this legislation very apparent to us both. In my professional work as a school principal and in volunteer work with gay and lesbian youth, I've seen many examples of how this debate affects young people. First of all, the fact that we are all even debating whether the state ought to recognize gay and lesbian couples sends a very clear signal to kids.
No, you're okay.
Okay. Sends a very clear signal to kids that our relationships are somehow not as good as others. Combined that with the relentless homophobia that young people encounter daily in our popular culture, and you begin to understand the strong and persistent messages that support a culture of homophobia and discrimination in our school systems. By voting for House Bill 2007, you will be sending a powerful statement to counteract the devaluing, dehumanizing messages that kids get every day. You will be creating a new environment with healthy, affirming possibilities for them. You'll be establishing new horizons for young people who before now may not have been able to see past tomorrow.
you'll also be affirming the struggles that many of us have endured for years to form and maintain our own relationships in the face of the environment that Gus just described. As our peers began to date and establish lifetime relationships in their teens and 20s, neither of us received guidance as to how we might do the same, nor did we see many models of healthy, loving relationships. Not that those examples weren't there, they just were almost entirely absent from the public discourse. When we committed ourselves to each other in 1997 in a wonderful summer ceremony, we had no support or guidance from our families to do so, and made it up ourselves, even writing a series of columns about our experiences for a local gay newspaper to guide others. In fact, when we mark the 10th anniversary of that ceremony in late June of this year, we'll do so knowing that we got to where we are largely on our own through our commitment and love to each other, with very little of the benefit that society gives to heterosexual couples, but with better results, I might point out, than most of those couples unfortunately have. Not long ago, I was speaking with a legislator friend and was asking how he might respond to critics who would say House Bill 2007 is marriage by another name. He knows, as we all do, that the vast majority of marriage rights are conferred by the federal government, which the Oregon legislature, of course, does not control. His answer was, "I hope that it's as close to marriage as we can make it, because I know in my heart that's the right thing to do." I couldn't agree more, and I think it speaks well of this legislature that it is now the home of a fair-minded majority that believes all Oregonians are created equal and should enjoy the same rights under our laws. Gus and I applaud your leadership as you move forward on this bill and take a stand not only for the adults who will benefit from this measure immediately, but for the adults of tomorrow and the generation after that and the generation after that. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, and congratulations on becoming parents. That's wonderful.
Looking forward to it.
You're in for a wild ride.
Yeah, we have older kids. We haven't really been there.
Okay, now we will have Amelia Voles and Alec Vesely.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the Judiciary Committee. My name is Amelia Voles. I am a Salem resident. I am also a mother. And I am a Catholic U.S. citizen and a philosophy and theology student. I come here today to urge you to oppose House Bill 2007 because, based on recent research, homosexuality is high risk for physical, mental, and emotional problems. Homosexuals have not been shortchanged in economic, education, or employment opportunities. There is clear evidence now that homosexuals are not born that way, and that there is not such a thing as a gay gene. That homosexuality is the result of multiple factors and a behavioral choice. There is a high correlation between child molestation and homosexuality. I have here with me an 18-page summary of recent research that supports the facts I have just stated. Some highlights include: one study found that the life expectancy of homosexuals is 43 years due to its significantly increased risk for HIV/AIDS, hepatitis, anal cancer, gonorrhea, and gastrointestinal infections as a result of their sexual practices. at least 9 separate studies done since 1990 have found that homosexual youth have significantly higher rates of suicide. There is a high degree of destructive behavior among homosexuals, including alcohol and drug abuse, and emotional and physical violence. To read you from the report that I have, 10 facts about homosexual men, according to the Gay and Lesbian Medical Association, in a press release issued through Gay Wired on June 10th, 2002, and I will read that to you, men having sex with men are at risk, increased risk for HIV infection, a fact that is well known. Also, the last few years have seen the return of many unsafe sex practices. Homosexual men use substances at higher rate than general population. This includes, I cannot even read the different things there, amyl nitrate, poppers, marijuana, ecstasy, and amphetamines. Depression and anxiety affect homosexuals at a higher rate than general population. Men having sex with men are at an increased risk of sexually transmitted infections with the viruses that cause the serious condition of the liver known as hepatitis, which can lead to cirrhosis and liver cancer. Sexually transmitted diseases occur in sexually active homosexuals at high rate. This includes the sexually transmitted disease infections for which treatment is available and for those which there is no cure. Homosexual men are at risk for death by prostate, testicular, and colon cancer. Homosexual men have higher rates of alcohol dependence and abuse than heterosexual men. Homosexual men use tobacco at much higher rates than heterosexual men, reaching nearly 50% in some studies. Tobacco-related health problems include lung disease, lung cancer, heart disease, high blood pressure, and a host of other serious problems. Homosexual men are more likely to experience an eating disorder such as bulimia and anorexia. Anorexia nervosa, and overweight and obesity.
I want to stop you here. This is a very thick report, and I'm going to ask you to summarize.
Okay, I'm not going to read all of that. I have to finish. May I finish the rest of the report, please?
Are you going from your written testimony?
I had just one little section that I was almost finished with that I was going to go back to.
Okay, I'll give you one more minute.
Okay. At least 9 separate studies, regarding their privileged economic status, based on a study of 6,000 U.S. citizens, the average combined income of homosexual couples is 60% higher than the average U.S. income. Regarding homosexuality, as a multifaceted issue that involves a behavioral choice, a 1970 Kinsey Institute study found that 81% of 684 gays and 93% of 293 lesbians had changed or shifted their sexual feelings or behaviors after the age 12. If homosexuals were born that way, change would not be possible. A new study by clinical neurologists George Rice and George Ebers of the University of Western Ontario in London, Ontario, and their colleagues have overturned earlier results suggesting a genetic basis for homosexuality. Regarding its correlation with child molestation, in Science, a review of the professional literature.
Okay, are you just about
published,
done now?
Just about finished. You can see my report. I have one paragraph to go.
All right.
In Science, a review of the professional literature published in a referred scientific journal is considered to be an accurate summary of the current state of knowledge. The latest such review was published in 1985. It concluded that homosexual acts were involved in 25 to 40% of the cases of child molestation recorded in scientific and forensic literature. Because gay lifestyle poses high risk with physical, mental, and emotional problems, because gays are not an underprivileged class, because homosexuality is not a genetically determined phenomenon, and because its association with higher cases of child molestation, I do not believe it should be granted special privileges under law. If people choose to live, I'm just about to.
No, you said this like three times. It's done.
Excuse me, Mr.
You are covered by the First Amendment, which is a good thing today.
Excuse me, Mr. Amendment. There are few of us that are representing the opposite. May I?
I know, but I gave you a time limit, and it's time to wrap up. I'll give you 30 seconds.
Thank you very much. If people choose to live such a lifestyle, they already have the freedom to do so. For those who are in favor of this bill, out of pity or mercy for homosexuals, I beg you to instead truly love your neighbor by instead opposing such legislature because their lifestyle is clearly not good for them. If we seek the true good of the gay community, we will not endorse legislature which will likely increase their chances of engaging in unhealthy lifestyle. Thank you very much for your attention.
You want to say something, Senator Pazansky?
I would. I'd like to have Ms. Volz. You've made some pretty, amazing statements from my perspective. I've been a prosecutor for 20 years. I've never had a case that involved child abuse that was a person was a homosexual. Everyone has been a heterosexual that I have prosecuted. So I'd love to get the actual supporting documentation that shows that the, as you said, a high correlation is actually represented by within the homosexuality community, because I can tell you from my anecdotal prosecution for 20 years, I've yet to see that to be the case, but instead to be where it's been fathers, aunts, uncles, parents,
boyfriends living in outside
of
marriage.
Okay, okay, all right.
Excuse me, I have from pages 13 to 18
just
of the report that I'm providing. It provides you
we will provide that for the record, pages 13 to 18. Other questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Walker.
I'm a duly elected senator of the state of Oregon, and I'm sworn to uphold the laws of the state of Oregon, and I do that. And I sat here very patiently, but I was quite frankly shocked by some of the statements made today. And Senator Prozansky is a prosecutor. I have been a survivor. And out of the seven men in my life who sexually abused me, not one of them was a homosexual. So I'm just putting that out there, and I've said it before, and I'll say it again.
Excuse me, it's not your turn. Please wait.
You haven't been invited to respond to me. Thank you.
May I respond?
No. We heard quite a bit from you. Thank you very much.
Okay. It's your turn, and you will have 3 minutes.
Okay, thank you. My name is Alec Vesely, and I'm a Portland resident. I'll just go through a few points. I do have to agree with what Amelia said in the evidence that she provided for the unhappiness, the lack of fulfillment, the self-alienation and destructiveness of homosexuality. I think anybody who looks at the evidence honestly will find that that's the case. What I came here to emphasize, or a few things, was that as legislators, well, let me back up. The popular expression is that you can't legislate morality. But that's actually a lie. You always legislate morality. Every law that's passed has to have a moral basis to it. Not a legal, technical basis, not some popular emotional basis, but it has to be based on morality. And that is the basis of the laws of the United States of America. And if you don't believe me, maybe, you know, read Blackstone, read Clash of Orthodoxies by Robert George of Princeton University. He will very clearly show that historically and rightfully, that is what all laws are based on. You cannot, as legislatures, pass a law that you know is immoral. And I don't know if that vocabulary speaks to you at all. I don't know if that's a new concept. But what is the basis? What is the moral basis of homosexuality? Why would you pass a law that protects something for which you cannot find a moral basis for? Yeah, you can find vague concepts that have been tortured, like equality under the law, or diversity, which I don't seem to find a lot in this room. Yeah, you can find those abstracts to base a law on, but that's not the lasting basis of a law. So I ask you to please review and please consider any law that you pass to find what is the moral basis for it. And I do agree that this is basically a backdoor marriage. We already voted on this. There is overwhelming opposition to it. And you're basically just changing the wording to it. It's a behavior-based classification for which you're creating a protected class. And I don't think you're doing anybody in this room a service by trying or by claiming that they're that they're a legitimate, happy relationship. Because what's going to happen if this law passes is basically a dilution of existing marriage, as we've seen in Scandinavian countries, as we've seen in Europe, because people will basically opt out of the hard, responsible vow of marriage to take this counterfeit on. You'll have more unhappiness. If this law passes, nobody in this room is going to be more happy in 10 years from now. In fact, they'll be maybe a little more confused because they thought that the social acceptance that was going to solve all their problems resolved it for them, and it's not going to resolve it. Check with me 10 years from now. Tell me if you're happier. Tell me if you're more fulfilled. And I didn't hear a lot in this room about the rights of children. There's a lot about me, about our relationship, about our sense of being offended. What about the rights of children? What about the right of a child to have a mother and a father? Has anybody considered that right? And has anyone considered how same-sex unions violate that right? I didn't hear a lot about that today. And I'm also offended with the implication that somehow high education and gays go together, and how Nike and the spokesman or spokeswoman from PGE, a.k.a. Enron, were here saying that they wanted to attract a highly educated workforce. And the only way to do that is to have diversity and same-sex acceptance.
Okay,
that's offensive.
It's time to wrap up now.
Okay, I'll just wrap it up again. Any law that you pass has to have a moral foundation. You cannot knowingly pass a law that has no moral foundation, that is immoral. We've done it in the past, and only bad comes from it.
Thank you. Questions from the panel? Thank you. Commissioner Adams, did you wish to testify, or are you just here to listen?
Sure.
Rana. Welcome.
Madam Chair and committee, I just wanted to stop by and thank you. My name is Sam Adams, commissioner for the City of Portland. I just wanted to stop by and thank you for your consideration of this legislation. It's important to tens of thousands of Oregonians. As someone who grew up in Newport, Oregon, and Eugene, Oregon, and lived in Salem, Oregon, that do not share the same local protections from discrimination that residents of Portland enjoy because of local legislation. These two bills are very important. The bill that you're considering today is not something that local government has any purview over, and you are it. And so I just wanted to stop by and thank you for your consideration and hope that you will move it forward. It means a lot to families and children across Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you, Commissioner Adams, for your leadership. Okay, we have Deborah Dixon, Brenda Smith, and Ashlyn Coughlin.
Madam Chair, Senators, thank you for this opportunity to speak today in favor of House Bill 2007. My name is Debbie Dixon. I'm a 50-year-old nurse at OHSU, a mother of two, and a grandmother of four.
I'm Brenda Smith, 59 years old. I'm a nurse. I have a PhD in education. I'm the former dean of nursing at Linfield College and the mother of four. I'm also a retired major in the U.S. Army. We're late bloomers, meaning that we came to find out that we were lesbians in the second half of our life. And because we're now in a same-sex relationship, we lack many of the basic protections that we used to have.
It never occurred to me that the rights and responsibilities that I had in a heterosexual relationship could be taken away just because of who I loved. I took them for granted. Yet now, because I love a woman, they were all taken away. And we really don't understand why. We pay taxes, we're good citizens, we obey the laws, we contribute to society. Between us, we have six children and four grandchildren. We also support my mother. We might have to assume guardianship over a grandchild. Why can't we be treated like everyone else? Why can't Brenda inherit the money that we have already paid taxes on if something should happen to me?
Like straight couples, we are emotionally and economically interdependent. Preparing our income taxes has been real interesting. Sharing household and financial responsibilities. But yet lacking a legal relationship to each other, we lack critical protections. There's a perpetual misperception that, well, you can just go out and get legal documents signed to take care of that. Well, so far we've spent $500. We still don't feel like we have covered all our bases. It's quite time-consuming. I have literally spent days trying to deal with every nuance of our wills, and we keep thinking of situations that still need to be covered. It's really a good thing that we're not paying an attorney by the hour to figure this out, and my apology to those of you who are attorneys.
I'd like to draw an analogy as a nurse. I frequently encounter organ donation. I'm sure everybody here is familiar with that. And it is reinforced daily that you can have organ donor on your driver's license. You can tell your family and friends that you're an organ donor. The minute that you are deceased, it's up to your family to decide whether you're an organ donor or not. And that also has to do with us. If we have health issues, burial, when it comes down to the wire, anyone, my mother, our children, Brenda's brother, any relation that someone considers can make decisions for us that we might not have chosen to make, or they are not the person that we want to make them.
So it refers to our wills, our advance directives, our personal property, our funeral arrangements. There's a constant gnawing for us, because of our age, about hospitalization, retirement, our own demise, that anyone, even an estranged relative, and that is an actual possibility, could come in and change things. I've seen it happen with my stepmother, who died the year after my father, and her son not only refused to obtain the health care recommended for her, but he refused my brother's entry to the house to obtain articles that had been my family for eons. I'd like to draw another analogy of life then and now. On September 11th, 2001, I'm sure you all remember that date, my husband of 32 years was taken to the emergency room suffering a dissecting aortic aneurysm. After surgery and 10 days in the hospital, he died. The whole time he was in the hospital, the staff accepted me as his wife. They allowed me to make decisions, including the decision to turn everything off and let him die. I couldn't find his advance directive. I really looked for it, but I couldn't find it. But that didn't make any difference. I made decisions about his life, his death, his autopsy, his cremation, his memorial service, and his funeral. Not once did anyone ask for proof of marriage or question my ability to make those decisions. And although he died without a will, I inherited everything with minimal effort and cost involved as he would have desired.
Currently, we still don't have wills that allow our property to be distributed as we desired. Whether or not we can visit each other in the hospital is determined by the hospital and what our respective next of kin say. We can only hope that our burial wishes will be honored by our children. And because we love each other, we can't be sure of any of this. One last thought. We're both nurses. We take care of others. We do for them things that they cannot do for themselves. We respect people's rights across the board. You senators have the right to expect that from nurses. Please give us the same care and respect.
Thank you.
Hi. Good afternoon. My name is Ashlyn Coghlan, and I'm the Interim Executive Director of Basic Rights Oregon, the largest advocacy group for the rights of gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people. Our mission is to eliminate discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity, and we see House Bill 2007 as a powerful step towards that end. I've submitted written testimony which supports this House bill, but I'm going to take a few moments just to address some of the issues that we've heard discussed today. First, for us, reciprocal benefits are really no substitute for domestic partnerships. That's why states like Vermont, who have reciprocal benefits law, only offer about a dozen of the legal rights and responsibilities that would be included in domestic partnerships. What's more, since reciprocal benefits were enacted in Vermont 5 years ago, no one has actually chosen to have one. While it makes sense at some point for the legislature to explore further the legal issues and possible need for reciprocal benefits, it will never be a substitute for domestic partnerships. They address two different types of issues and two different types of relationships. In looking at Measure 36, the Oregon Family Council and its partner, the so-called Defense of Marriage Coalition, has clearly stated that legal recognition for same-sex relationships, such as domestic partnerships as created through House Bill 2007, do not violate Measure 36. In September of 2004, while seeking passage of Measure 36, coalition spokesperson Georgine Rice told the Dolls Chronicle that the coalition's amendment did not preclude the state of Oregon from creating civil unions so that same-sex couples could have the same rights as married heterosexual couples. Most importantly, during that campaign, these same organizations told Oregonians that in no uncertain terms that if same-sex couples need legal protection, they should consult their legislative representatives. If they need the legislation to do that, no one's going to stand in their way. So we're here today, as they suggested, asking that you do provide protections for same-sex families, that you do provide rights and responsibilities that legal recognition brings, and we ask that you move this to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm glad you got that on the record because I followed that campaign very, very closely, the Measure 36 campaign, and indeed the proponents did clarify time and time again that they were not campaigning against civil marriages, against civil unions or domestic partnerships, that was a different issue, and they did not take a position against these type of benefits, and in my opinion, that is why they got as many votes as they did. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you. Okay, we're going to have Kathy Savicki, Gina Frizzini, and Becky Flynn. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kathy Savicki. I'm a Salem resident and a social worker, and I'm here representing the National Association of Social Workers Oregon chapter, which is 1,700 professionals working in the community with families and children. And these issues related to families are very much at the heart of our professional practice. Our national board of directors supports the development of legally recognized relationships for same-sex couples at the national and state level, and our local chapter strongly supports House Bill 2007. At least 1 million children are being raised by same-sex parents in the United States, according to the most recent census, and the legal recognitions and protections that this bill would provide for them are just as important for their children as they are for other families. We're in alignment with the American Academy of Pediatrics, which, based on their extensive research, also supports that same-sex couples receive the same kind of legal protections for their families as other families do. A common argument against legally recognized relationships for same-sex couples is that the family structure is detrimental to children. We'd like to set the record straight. The science is very clear on this, and legal recognition and protection for these couples and the legal rights that flow to their children would only be to the benefit of children. In my written testimony, which I hope is coming around, there's some citation of several extensive literature reviews. The most recent one is in 2006, looked most carefully at the effect of parental sexual orientations on the development of their children, and can really find no correlation whatsoever. What seems to make a difference in the outcomes for children is the quality of the relationship between the parents, and has nothing to do with the sexual orientation of the parents. I also would add that from my own clinical practice, I would note that there really is no correlation between mental stability and sexual orientation. You see the same kinds of issues across the spectrum regardless of people's choice of sexual partners. And it's a real misattribution to think that the real risk factors, like high risk of suicide for gay adolescents, is caused by homosexuality rather than caused by stigma and discrimination and people's not having models of healthy life options for themselves. So I want to make sure we correct that. To close, I want to say that the association supports the finding of the research, which says that these kinds of protections would be only helpful for children and their families. This is a personal issue for me. I brought a wedding picture of my wonderful gay daughter that I'm very proud of. She's a native of Oregon and an honors graduate of Central High School, currently in California finishing a doctorate in psychology. And she and her partner are going to be fabulous parents. And my dearest dream is that the two of them will bring their skills when they finish their graduate degrees back to Oregon and settle into welcoming communities, raise their families here, and that my grandchildren, because of the actions of this legislature, are going to have the full protections of the law just like my children did and everyone else's children. So I thank you very much for helping make that happen.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Welcome.
Hi, thank you, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. My name is Gina Frazzini. This is my youngest son, Griffin Harmon. He's just 9 months old this month. Behind me is my partner, Katie Parman, and our oldest boy, Emmett, who's 3 years old. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. I wanted to start off, I think it's interesting watching the testimony so far today, that we introduce ourselves in relation to our families, no matter what side we're on in this discussion, and that just underscores for me how important this legislation is, because the most important thing in our lives is those primary relationships that we form with our families and our children. So we wanted to share with you just our personal experience as a way of illustrating how critical this legislation is for real people in Oregon. And I'll just start by saying that after Katie and I had been in a, we're coming up on a 10-year anniversary this year, and it was after 7 years in a committed relationship that we finally got to the point where we felt like we were adult enough and stable enough in our careers that we could start a family. And our hopes were realized when Katie became pregnant in mid-2003. And as the due date approached, we had all the typical anxieties of first-time parents. Were we ready? Would the baby be healthy? Could we juggle work, life, and childcare duties and raise a healthy, happy child? But added to those anxieties were additional concerns that are typical of same-sex couples living in the state of Oregon about we had no legally recognized relationship to each other at the time, and we had already gone through extensive and expensive legal documentation, wills, powers of attorney, anything we could come up with, or the lawyers could come up with, that would potentially protect our relationship and our family. But those protections fell very short of what other Oregon families take for granted. So when Emmett's due date was March 7th of 2004, and you may remember that on March 3rd of 2004, Multnomah County issued marriage license to same-sex couples, and we thought, this is our chance. If we can squeeze in the marriage before we get to the hospital, which we did on our way to the hospital, then I would have instant recognition as the second parent of our child. We wouldn't have to go through the lengthy and expensive second parent adoption. And if anything, God forbid, had happened to Katie giving birth to Emmett, there would be no question as to who would be responsible for his care. And that was so important to us because there had been difficulties in the pregnancy. It was very, we got to the hospital that night after our wedding ceremony. Susan Leo was the pastor who married us, as a matter of fact. went through a long, difficult labor. 2 days later, Emmett was born. Thankfully, everyone was in great health. And before we left the hospital, we filled out the paperwork for the birth certificate, listing both Katie and my names as parents. And a few weeks later, the official document arrived. In fact, I think on the back of my written testimony, you have a copy of the form that we filled out in the hospital.
Can you wrap this up? I just looked at the clock.
Oh, am I out of time already?
Yeah.
Basically, you have the form on the back of my written testimony. An administrator at the hospital saw two women's names on the birth certificate, and with a stroke of the pen, she crossed me out of my son's life, giving me no legal rights, giving him no legal rights. And that continues today with the birth of our second son. We have no legal relationship. House Bill 2007 will remedy that situation, and that's why we're here to support it. And I really thank you for your time, and the rest of my comments are in the written testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome, and I would ask you to be very brief because we're running out of time.
Absolutely. Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. My name is Rebecca Flynn. I am a constituent of Senator Przanski, proud to be, and a great fan of the lion-hearted Senator Walker. I am also most recently a stay-at-home mom and have recently returned to work. My partner Sharon and I just celebrated our 10-year anniversary last month, and during the past 10 years, we have attempted to secure legal recognition for our relationship in several ways. In 1998, we applied for domestic partnership status in Washington, D.C. In 2001, we got a Vermont civil union. In 2002, we were wed by a Catholic priest in a church before 125 family, friends, and colleagues. And in 2004, we were married by a minister in our new home state of Oregon. As you know, that marriage was ruled null from the beginning. In 2005, we finally resolved to scrape together the $1,500 to hire a lawyer to draft legal documents which would allow us to make medical and financial decisions for one another should tragedy strike. When Sharon was about to give birth to our daughter, we made sure that we packed those legal documents when we took the bag with us to the hospital. And after hours of labor, the OBGYN informed us that Sharon would have to deliver by cesarean section. Once that decision was made, things began happening very quickly, and a doctor and staff whom we did not know showed up and started wheeling Sharon to the operating room. I found myself scrambling to locate my medical power of attorney and found myself running after them, waving the documents, saying, just so you know, in case something bad happens, I've got medical decision-making power. I've got the paperwork right here. And the doctor looked at me like I was crazy, and I felt panicked and embarrassed. But I also knew that I had to speak up in case something happened. And if I needed to make a decision or even stay informed about Sharon's welfare. So fortunately, the C-section went well. Our daughter Haley was born 2 years ago. But I never want to be put in that situation again. And if either Sharon or I have to be rushed to the hospital, I don't want either of us to have to rifle through our filing cabinet to find those documents. I don't want to have to carry them with me on a camping trip. I just want to be treated under the law of Oregon as what I am, which is the spouse of Sharon Flynn. So thank you very much, and I also want to thank you for your service as senators. I know it takes a lot out of you.
Thank you very much. Okay, we will have very brief testimony from one more opponent, one neutral, and one proponent. And then we will see if we have any more time after that. So we'll start with Carolyn Wendell in opposition, and I will limit you to 2 minutes.
Thank you, Senator Burdick. Thank you for this opportunity. My name is Carolyn Wendell, and I am the director of VOCAL. It's a Catholic lay apostolate, which is in opposition to the Catholic Church in the Western Oregon Diocese being part of Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon. I would like to read to you from relevant magisterial teaching regarding the considerations regarding proposals. This is from the J. Paul II Institute for Marriage for Studies on Marriage and Family. This is from the Congregation for Doctrine of the Faith. The CDF declares there's absolutely no grounds for considering homosexual unions to be in any way similar or even remotely analogous to God's plan for marriage and family. Marriage is holy when homosexual acts go against the natural moral law and close the sexual act to the gift of life. They do not proceed from a genuine affective and sexual complementarity. If the government's policy is de facto tolerance with no explicit recognition of homosexual unions, moral conscience requires that Christians give witness to the whole moral truth. We are clearly stating the immoral nature of these unions, reminding the government of the need to contain the phenomenon within certain limits so as to safeguard public morality, and above all, to avoid exposing young people to erroneous ideas about sexuality and marriage. If such unions have been given legal recognition or the rights and status of marriage, clear and emphatic opposition is a duty. The present considerations are also intended to give direction to Catholic politicians by indicating the approaches to proposed legislation in this area, which would be consistent with Christian conscience. And that's what I'm speaking to. The CDF declares, nor is the argument valid according to which legal recognition of homosexual unions is necessary to avoid situations in which cohabiting homosexual persons, simply because they live together, might be deprived of real recognition of their rights as persons as citizens. In reality, they can always make the use of the provisions of law to protect their rights in matters of common interest. It would be gravely unjust to sacrifice the common good and just laws of the family in order to protect personal goods that can and must be guaranteed in ways that do not harm the body of society.
Ms. Wendell, I see you have some written material there. You can put that on the record.
Well, it's not a whole bunch. That's what I'm saying.
Well,
the
2 minutes are up, and we are running out of time.
Okay.
So if you can pick two sentences that best sum it up
okay,
for you.
Okay, the bottom line is that the congregation says that they would approve like relationships that were based not on just sexuality, but other relationships that are same-sex based on friendship, like mom and daughter, things like that. The bottom line here is the CDF answers those who ask how a law can be contrary to the common good. It says one needs to reflect on the difference between homosexual behavior as a private phenomenon and the same behavior as a relationship in society. The second phenomenon is not only more serious if it becomes part of the legal structure, it assumes a more widely reaching and profound influence and would result in changes to the entire organization of society contrary to the common good. One sentence.
Okay, one more.
The legal recognition of homosexual unions would obscure certain moral basic values and cause a devaluation of the institution of marriage. Thank you.
Thank you very much,
Senator.
And feel free
You've been very patient.
Thank you. Okay, Bonnie Tinker is signed up as neutral. Welcome. 2 minutes.
Come on. I'm the only neutral person. I should have
15
minutes.
Well, that's true. You should probably have an hour, but life is not fair.
At least 15. The problem is I got 15, but I'll try 3, okay? I'm bringing testimony from myself, Bonnie Tinker, and from my spouse, Sarah Graham, today. She's not able to be here. I am the director of Love Makes a Family, Inc. I might start by saying that both of us have evidently outlived our life expectancy. My spouse is 66. I am 57. We have 3 children, 3 grandchildren, all healthy, and not a divorce between us. This is Sarah's testimony. I don't feel good about testifying for or against this bill that purports to do great things for me and my family and the gay community. I don't want to testify on the same side of this issue as those who don't believe our family should exist, or on the side of those who think we should be satisfied with less than full equality.
Okay, I'm going to stop you right here. We have your written testimony, and I'd like you to sum it up very quickly.
Okay, I want to say the part from me, because this, I think, needs to be heard by everybody. If for political reasons all we dare request at this time are domestic partnerships, then at least amend this bill to make domestic partnerships open to all, without regard to sex or sexual orientation. If we must bear the indignity of having our marriages called domestic partnerships, at least set an example that family laws should be non-discriminatory by amending HB 2007 to delete reference to sex and gender. I know at least 3 heterosexual couples in Oregon who have not married because they do not want to accept special rights that are not available to same-sex couples.
I know two more young opposite-sex couples who are planning to marry in the fall and are struggling with whether or not they will also accept legal marriage rights because of this discrimination. One of these couples feels that they may have to accept discriminatory legal marriage because of health concerns. Access to domestic partnerships would leave these couples with a moral alternative to accepting discriminatory special marriage rights. Beyond practical considerations, equality is the right thing to do. Please amend HB 2007 to eliminate discrimination based on sex. Discrimination is wrong. Separate is not equal. I've also attached an article from New York where the governor there is pushing legislation for marriage equality. And once you pass this bill, I hope you will immediately begin the process to overturn Amendment 36. Thank you.
Thank you for testifying.
Madam Chair, I just have one comment. Ms. Tinker, I remembered your testimony. You testified in front of us on March 12th, and you said you at that time that you had first testified in 1973 on this issue, and that was on Senate Bill 2. That bill has now been passed, and I'm so happy that after all these years that you've seen your dream come true.
Thank you so much. And I want to say that I hope this is one of the last times I ever have to testify on anything like this, because it amounts to sexual abuse for those of us who are here to testify on behalf of this legislation to have to sit through what we have heard today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, I'm now going to give Susan Leo, our last witness, a minute and a half.
You don't want to get up there.
Okay, 2 minutes.
Okay.
We are going to enforce this because we are just about out of time and we have work to do.
Right. Much easier said than done.
Welcome.
Yeah, I'm good. Thank you. I really appreciate being able to speak with you this afternoon. I am a pastor.
I'm
Reverend Susan Leo. I'm pastor at Bridgeport United Church of Christ in Portland. I had the great joy of officiating at over 125 weddings 3 years ago, and then the same great sorrow that those weddings were nullified. This last month, I had the great sorrow of accompanying a woman, Lynn, and her daughter Ari to the mortuary to claim the remains of her spouse of 23 years. They knew that Sean wanted to be cremated, and they got to the mortuary to make these arrangements, and the man who was helping them, very sweet, very loving, very tender, said to Lynn, "I cannot allow you to sign these papers." Her partner Sean was an attorney. She made all the papers that were possible to make, you know, and which all expired when she did. And their 18-year-old daughter had to be the one to sign the orders for her to be cremated. And it's very interesting because her daughter was adopted, but they never asked to see the adoption papers. But Lynn was faced with that trauma and heartbreak of not being able to take care of her partner in her death. And I am so relieved that HR 2007 takes care of this. You know, Hospital 2007 will deal with this so that, and we've talked about the joy in our family and the traumas in our families around our children and our health and so forth, but to be there when your partner has died and to not have the right to say this is how she would like to be dealt with is an insult and a heartbreak that no one should have to deal with. And I really appreciate all the good work that you all have done here on this bill, and I look forward to celebrating the passage of this law. Thank you so much.
Thank you for coming. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, I just want to thank Reverend Leo because you've been a real blessing for people who've wanted to be together, and the law hasn't allowed them to do that. And it was a very poignant story you just shared with us. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. With that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2007 and thank the people in the audience who came here. This hasn't always been an easy day for any of us. And with that, I will open a work session. and ask for a motion from Senator Walker.
Do we have any amendments?
We don't have any.
Okay. Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2007 to the floor of the Senate of the State of Oregon with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Walker has moved House Bill 2007 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair.
Senator Beyer.
Appreciate if you call the roll. And also, I see on my staff manager summary the fiscal statement has been issued. I don't have a fiscal statement. Is there a fiscal statement? And if there is, what does it say?
It was not my understanding that there was a fiscal impact, but we will have counsel.
I've asked him to check.
Okay. Senator Beyer, it's not my understanding that there was a fiscal impact on this bill. But, what's your wish? Did
you call the roll? I just want to.
Okay. I think we're going to go ahead and move forward because the powers that be have ways of accommodating fiscals when they exist. Call the roll, please.
Senator Cruz? Excuse? Senator Kozlowski?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Beyer?
No.
Chair Byrd?
Aye. House Bill 2007 is approved, and Senator Brown and I will carry it. Thank you, everyone. We are adjourned.